Watching it all last night, but then I had to get some sleep. Yes, if you find a show that you want to binge, you just might end up being antisocial and maybe render yourself unemployed soon. So it's best to do the right thing. Another one says, hi, Amanda. Someone, I haven't been called that in a while, in a long time. The Serpent is chilling, riveting and scary. Edge of your seat stuff. Tahar Rahim as Charles Sobhraj is just incredible. The fact that it's based on a true story of a living serial killer who shows no remorse whatsoever makes it even more impactful. You feel that the cast aren't acting, but that you're watching the real thing. The fashion, the vehicles, the backpackers from the 70s are depicted perfectly. I'm sold. Here's my... my slip, can I have my slip, please? Because I'm sold on this one. So hopefully we've put some interesting things on the radar for you this weekend. It's what we do every Friday, a collection of things that hopefully will make your weekend that much more interesting. Later on, we're going to bring you some music. You will meet Anna Wolf. She might seem familiar. That's because she used to go by a different name when she was on the show before. South African-born, London-based artist, award-winning, in fact, Anna Wolf will be joining us, not only for a catch-up, but also for a performance. And you'll be able to watch this performance live. We're streaming it today. I'm so excited. I've got cameras in front of me. You'll be able to see her, chat to us, and watch the performance. So go to the YouTube page, the 702 YouTube page, to be able to watch 702 Unplugged live.
702.
The upside of failure.
Sometimes failure is the foundation of greatest success stories.
It's now 9 minutes past two. Every Friday, we just invite a South African, an interesting South African, to come and talk to us about the upside of failure in their life. You know, success is not guaranteed, but what is universal is failure. It's universal to all of us, and it's something we hardly ever put a spotlight on. We're obsessed with success, with the moment of winning, but there's so much more that happens in between. So the upside of failure is our opportunity to look at those in-between moments, between the successes, what is going on. And so often what we've discovered, what we've learned, is that failure is the stepping stone. These failures in our lives are like stepping stones to success. And so this afternoon, we've invited respected and renowned journalist, that is Karen Morn. She is our guest today on The Upside of Failure. And over the years, Karen has delivered some impressive, just impeccable professional journalism over the years. She's helped us make sense of all those political and legal cases that are so complicated to follow. I suspect that at her house, she probably has a wall full of maps that connect everything, all these stories over the years. She's always on that beat. And of course, she's known for that legal beat. Karen, good afternoon.
Thank you. I will tell you that when my brother came to visit me, he was actually surprised that my flat was normal. He too expected like a wall shrine. He said he was going to call it the hovel with like people's pictures all over the stuff. Yes. And I was like, no, Paul, that is not how I live.
That's what I would have thought, so like strings. Exactly. Markers and lines crisscrossing to like the opposite end of
the wall. This is literally the whole vibe that he had going. I think he was a little bit disappointed when I didn't have a wall full of strings and various other things on it.
Yeah. So now that you've talked about your brother, let's actually explore a little bit of your childhood, because you were born in Joburg, but your family hopped around. You lived in several coastal towns. Just tell me a little bit about your family. With my family, we call ourselves the Awesome Four because, you know, it's my mom and like her three kids and stuff. But tell me about the home you come from.
So I have an amazing family. I mean, my parents, my mom had been married before and she met my dad sort of later in life, and they got married. I think she was sort of mid 30s, and they had us sort of later than, you know, the average time period that people were having kids then. And I think the thing that was amazing for me is that my parents really my mom wasn't sure, you know, that she was going to be able to have kids because, you know, she was a bit older. She had my younger sister when she was 40. And so our entire childhood was suffused with this sense of like kind of gratitude. I don't know how to describe it, but I never, ever, ever doubted that I was loved and that my parents were really grateful that they had us. And for me, it was amazing because, I mean, I developed diabetes when I was 4 and a half, and I have an autoimmune disorder, which meant I was in and out of hospital and had a lot of health issues as a kid. Mm-hmm. But because I had these parents that were like, you know what, you can do anything, it's fine, we're just going to sort it out, I think I was very lucky in growing up, you know, just simply believing that this was an aspect of my life. It wasn't something that was going to ever stop me from doing what I needed to do. And I think that was kind of a remarkable gift that they gave to all their children, mm-hmm. who are very different. I mean, my brother's a pastor, and he's also a chartered accountant. He used to lecture at UCT, but now he's a full-time pastor. Mm-hmm. He's the most amazing human being, Paul. And he has three little ones and an amazing wife called Leanne. And then my youngest sister, Debbie, runs the COVID ward at Groote Schuur in Cape Town. Mm. And she is a remarkable woman, hugely brave, hugely empathetic, hugely compassionate. An introvert, the total opposite of me. But I'm just, you know, like this last year, having seen what she's gone through, and the kind of fortitude that she's displayed, so many health professionals have in these very trying circumstances, has just like raised my level of admiration for her so much.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I can see the three of you as, you know, siblings. I can see you in my mind's eye, a beautiful picture. But one of the areas that you said you would cite as where things didn't go right was in your childhood. And tell us about that, because, but before we get there, actually, I want to talk about you managing diabetes from such a young age. I just noted it now that you were quite young.
Yeah.
And obviously you've had to manage it over the years from a really, really young age. Were you scared?
You know what? Like, just God's grace. I mean, there were kids that I knew. There was a child that I knew that I'd been diagnosed with who passed away when we were 12.
Mm.
And I remember saying to my mom, like, why is Roscoe's mom, why is she trying to get rid of his blood test machine? Because I was so confused because it was in our little diabetic newsletter. And she said, no, Roscoe's in heaven. Mm. And it was like, it was hard for me to comprehend. My parents, I went into comas as a child. I still do as an adult.
Oh.
And a lot of kids don't make it, you know, and I was very lucky in that when I started going into comas, I would always wake up screaming. And that's what really consistently saved my life.
Mm.
But you know, the thing is with diabetes, it's really tough on parents because it is life threatening. I mean, if your child's blood sugar goes low to the point of them going into a coma, they can and will die. And so there's often a level of anxiety around having type 1 diabetic kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when they're little ones, you know, but my parents didn't put that fear on me, ever. I didn't grow up anxious. And when I wanted to go to Rhodes, my parents were like, you go to Rhodes. They just had this, deep sense. And I think it comes very embedded in my mother's faith that I was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has given me like a huge gift. But you know, one of the most heartbreaking things, Azania, is that we have so many children in the state healthcare system who are type 1 diabetics who, you know, struggle with, you know, the state healthcare system with younger diabetics is very helpful. But like, you know, there was when I was one of my doctors, and I'm in a private healthcare system, I'm very privileged, telling me that, you know, this young teenager was speaking at one of the diabetic camps that they held, and he was in the state system talking about how his blood sugar was going low and saying to his mom, please, can I have a peanut butter sandwich? And her saying, but we don't have food in the house. And that like just hit me in the guts. My youngest sister had a 19-year-old diabetic pass away from a diabetic coma. I mean, all you need to do is give the person sugar to stop it. And yet we still have children who die of comas, often as a direct consequence of their level of disadvantage. And that, you know, so for me, I've never, ever felt like, oh, shame, it's so hard, because I've always been protected. I've had access to the best healthcare. People have looked after me. I've been able to eat food all the time. I always have food. So I'm just very aware of just how terrible it is for people on the other side of the spectrum who don't have those things, yeah. and how absolutely terrifying it must be to literally feel like your blood sugar is dropping and you can't access food.
So death's door is an ever possible reality anytime. Yes, for all of us, but you know, to be that aware of it due to circumstances, it is, as you describe, horrifying. So do tell us the story. Your first one, as you say, that this is one area where things were not as they should, but there were great lessons that came out of it, which is why we love these conversations, because initially where things are not necessarily right or go right, there's often such a ray of hope that emerges out of it. So I'm curious about the childhood failure that you mentioned.
So when I was about 6, I was at preschool and they put me on a trampoline and I just stared at them. I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And they said, something's wrong with this kid. Like, we have to go and have her tested. And there's something up. There's a remedial issue. So I was sent to a neurologist. I only discover this when I'm 19 and I actually find his report. And they say that because I was born, I had a forceps birth and I had an abnormally large head. I was born brain damaged. And there are certain things that I would like, for instance, I can't drive a manual car.
Oh.
I mean, the changing of the gears, I have fundamental coordination issues. As a child, I was constantly tripping over myself, breaking limbs, very clumsy, and just, you know, only learned to tie my shoes, I think, when I was 16 and learned how to tell time on a normal clock. About around that time as well, because my brain was literally like, this is not something that we do. And then my mom, you know, obviously I was remedially challenged, and then my mom started taking me to this lady called Mrs. Wright in Somerset West. And there was this recommendation from the neurologist of the school saying, listen, do you want to put her in a so-called special school because she's got these difficulties? We're not sure she's going to be able to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom just said, like, listen, she likes to read and she likes to draw. And we're just going to focus on those things.
Mm.
And if she struggles with school, then we'll take her out. But we're going to put her, you know, we'll put her in a mainstream school and see what happens. And it kind of taught me that, you know, my mom took me to the library every single day and I just devoured books, like devoured them.
So intuitively, was just intuitive to her.
Yeah, my mom, you know, in the beginning phases of my life, she'd been around me and she was just like, I can see what she loves, mm-hmm. and I'm going to just, that's what I'm going to focus on.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we have this weird thing of like, oh, I'm not good at that. I'm not good at that. I must try and get better. And this is a mark against me, but that is fine. But you need to focus on what you are good at,
mm-hmm.
because mm-hmm. you don't need to be trapped in this idea of trying to perfect something that's not intrinsic to you.
Mm-hmm.
Rather focus on what you love and what you're talented at and pour your time and energy into that,
because absolutely.
That is where you will find your excellence and your happiness.
Yeah, I got that advice years ago, which is what I do for my kids now, whether choosing grade 10 subjects, you know, the final subjects that you're going to go with, instead of say or forcing someone to work through an area that they just struggle through, rather let's take the ones that rise to the top, your highest grades, your top grades, and compile a 6 out of that, you know, and of course mandatory ones. But instead of just saying you're going to do maths come hell or high, yes, it's important, we understand, but it's just it's counter even long term, lifelong, just lean on the things that you're really, really good at. So many lessons out of that, Karen. I love that story about your mom. So that is that the lesson for you then, to really just focus and tap into what you're naturally good at, and instead of wasting time in areas that you are unlikely to ever improve in?
I think, you know, the thing is that we always carry those marks of so-called failure on us, and we allow what we're not good at to define who we are far more oftentimes than we actually say, you know what, this is my thing, this is my excellence. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, just having a parent, and my dad was always very supportive, but my mother literally is my favorite human in the whole world. And she's like shaped my
existence. You have a favorite parent.
In ways that I can't believe.
Usually,
I mean, everyone knows. My dad's like, no, it's fine, it's fine. You know, I adore my father. I adore my father. But like, you know, when you're like, I often say to people, like, my mother is the love of my life, because mm-hmm. like, she really, and when I was in hospital as a child, when we went through so many things, my mom was just there. She's just always,
oh, so beautiful.
Always been there.
It's beautiful.
And I get so emotional because she's an incredible human being. And I've been just so blessed to have her as a mother, because if with all kind of, with the diabetes, with the brain damage, with yeah. the remedial difficulties, with all of that stuff, it would have been very overwhelming for a lot of parents. Mm. And if she had started speaking that stuff of, oh, you've got these remedial difficulties, oh, you've got diabetes, oh, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, I'm not sure that I would have ever lived the life that I've lived now.
Yeah.
Because my mother just kept speaking over my life, but you can do this. Look at you. Like, you love your books. We're going to read your books. We're going to draw. We're going to, and she just made me think, wow, I am special. I can do things, and I love words, and this will be my thing. And,
yes.
and I think that you find those things in your children that they love, and you're just like, this is, you know, you support them in that.
Mm.
And I think that that was a huge, huge boost to, my self-confidence, and it permeated my whole life. Really.
That's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Now, you haven't always done hard news reporting, but over the years you've dabbled. Yes. You've dabbled into other forms of reporting, other kind of themes overall. There was a time when you tried your hand at entertainment reporting. How did that go?
This is terrible. You know what? I look at people, I mean, you are a master of like switching in between like a vast variety of, you know, in the entertainment space. And Anele, I mean, when I see her at the Oscars, I'm just like, wow, yeah. This woman is phenomenal. But yours truly, and I will, this is like so embarrassing. I start cringing. Trevor Noah had come back to South Africa and ENCA, and I was so excited. And ENCA said, no, you can go and interview him on the red carpet at some comedy festival.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it was terrible. first of all, I was so starstruck that I literally was like, you know, I was just like so beside myself that I could barely get the questions out. And then I was really just, you know, there's a kind of energy that it takes to be a brilliant entertainment journalist. And I in my experience, I mean, I always say people who have any kind of level of criticism for entertainment journalists must just sit down, because I have experienced it. It's damn hard. I will never do it again. And I mean, my sister thought it was hilarious. She was watching it on the TV, and then during the live, I finished the interview with him, I turned around and I said, I don't think that made so much on national television.
At least you're honest. And the other thing about what we do, because it's happening in the public, it's like having your homework marked in public, right? You just have to you just have to give yourself that grace, even acknowledge when things didn't go well. Be vulnerable. Allow yourself to be vulnerable. Oh, were they?
Twitter was brutal. Twitter's like, someone's like, please don't do this again. Don't quit your day job.
Oh, wow.
Which was not an unfair criticism. I mean, bless his heart, Trevor Noah was very nice about it. But gosh, I was terrible. So bad.
You know, at Nike,
it will never happen again.
So at Nike, they have a rule. If you work there, you're not allowed to be starstruck, because of course you're going to have the big acts, big sports stars walking through those corridors. You know, imagine walking down the passage and there's Tiger Woods, and you kind of like, oh, Tiger Woods, can I please have your autograph?
Yeah.
I loved you here. I loved you there.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. So there, it's a must that you cannot. You cannot walk around being starstruck when you see these big names.
You know, the thing is that I do it. I think I did it around him, and then I do it around some of my favorite judges. You know, I just stand there, just like, because I mean, I'm just, you know, beside myself, and you know, it's. You know, and also when you like speaking to, you know, an incredible lawyer or someone who's mm-hmm. like, it's just
quite
mind. Yeah, I have to work on it. I get so overwhelmed. But I mean, the Trevor Noah was like live on national television. I've learned since, you know, to try and temper it down. And when I am going to be starstruck, to be like, just to try and just prepare in my own mind, like a little, hi, I'm your biggest fan speech, and then retreat and shush, because it's otherwise it's, you know, you should really just try and rein that aspect of your personality in.
No, absolutely.
Because I think it's awkward for the poor person, like you interviewing, because they're literally like, what's wrong with this human being? Why is she standing there with a fixed expression on her face, beaming at me like a crazy person in the moonlight? I mean, it's not a good look at all.
There's a whole show. I think there's a whole show where we can have these disclosures, in fact. I remember interviewing Wynton Marsalis in the studio. And I mean, he's a jazz icon, jazz giant. And I was so nervous from the time the interview was booked. But I decided that, you know what? I'm going to be a big girl about this. I'm going to be big girl. I'm not going to let the little girl come out. We're not going to have time to get to your other failure, Karen, but we've got Leanne calling. Leanne has given us a call, so we'll end off with her. Leanne, I know you've been waiting to speak to Karen. Good afternoon.
To Karen the whole afternoon. She's absolutely inspiring and totally lovely. And just, I could just sit and listen to her all day. And then when she spoke about her mom, I was in tears because my mom brought up 8 children. And she was the woman that could give you the clothes off her back, but just she made each and every one of us feel like we were special. And I mean, we were all totally, totally different. But again, like Karen's mom, you know, focused on where we were good. And all of us felt like we were her favorites, which was obviously not. So thank you so much for a lovely, lovely guest this afternoon.
Wonderful, Leanne. Thank you. Thank you so much. So do you guys as siblings wonder who's your mom's favorite?
No, we ask her all the time and she's like, you're my favorite oldest girl baby. And Debbie's my favorite youngest girl baby.
Yes.
And Paul's my favorite boy baby.
Yeah,
so
and that settles
it. That's how she does it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it. She refuses to be drawn. But I, you know, I constantly tell her, listen, I know I'm your favorite. It's cool. We'll keep it on the DL. Because we like speak, me and my mother, we speak in the morning, we speak in the evening. Anytime anything happens, I phone her. I'm like, Mama, you know, this is what's going on. I need help. And it's just, I mean, she's just a remarkable person, and I wouldn't be the human being that I am without her. Oh. So I'm just grateful to God every day that he gave me her as a mother.
Yes, yes. Well, I know that my sister's my mom's favorite, so there. But I know I'm the best aunt. You've got to win some and you're going to lose some, you know. I thought we were going to be talking about failures, Karen, but instead it just ended up being really one of the most inspiring conversations about mother and daughter love. I'll never forget that. Absolutely beautiful. Thank you for sharing the intimacy and the specialness of the relationship you have with your mother.
And thank you so much for this opportunity. I think you have such a beautiful energy about you, and you're so generous in what you do and how you do it. And I think that kind of inspires these kind of conversations, which I hope just bring some light and love and joy into people's lives, especially now when we're all going through so much. And sometimes we feel quite overwhelmed by the kind of pain that we're experiencing. Just these conversations are like very affirming, not just for us, but I think also, and I hope, for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have a wonderful day. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And that was Karen Moore, absolutely respected, renowned, darling, 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 darling of a journalist. Karen Moore, bright mind. And when you think of her coming up and what she describes, of course, as learning challenges and how she's managed to overcome that, I think that's a source of inspiration. If you know a child, if you know anyone, in fact, who is struggling with any kind of learning disability, make them listen to this podcast. Make them look at Karen's work and you'll see that they will see that it is indeed possible.